This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Ruth Margraf and Kamala Shankaram. In the sanctuary now I'm at rest, like desert snow, we sentinels of silence come like water to these moments. This lightning, this lost music, lost in the heart of everything. Was Stephanie Foley Davis singing an excerpt of Ruth Margraf and Kamala Shankaram's Lost Music from the Heart of Everything, a suffrage aria for Amelia Hymes Walker. This piece is part of the 19th Amendment Project, a collection of work commissioned by Burning Coal Theater, the League of Women Voters of Wake County, and a dozen other Triangle Area Theater companies, including North Carolina Opera, who worked on this piece. Amelia Hymes Walker was a suffragist and women's rights activist. She was one of the Silent Sentinels, a group of women led by Alice Paul to picket the White House in 1917. She was arrested for insubordination and sentenced to 60 days in a workhouse. Shankaram and Margraf told me they connected to Walker's spirituality and activism on a personal level. Here's our conversation.
Hi, my name is Kamala Shankaram. I am a composer. I mostly work in opera and theater and a little bit of chamber music.
I am Ruth Margraf, and I also work in opera. I call it new opera. It's been called avant-garde opera. I also write plays, but my plays are often very musical. So even when somebody is just speaking, there's a kind of musicality hovering underneath the language. And I'm very interested in language. So I think I have been called a kind of poetic playwright.
Can you dive in a little bit or tell me a little bit about the avant-garde music world and how that intersects with theater?
So what's interesting about a lot of the avant-garde approach to opera is that it is more grounded, I think, in theatrical practices than even classical opera is, and that there's a lot of freedom for the performer. So like a lot of the experimental music that I've done has been what's called aleatoric, which is that there's an element of chance in it. So you have like a block of notes that you're supposed to sing, but it's up to you how you perform those notes. Similarly, a lot of this approach to vocal writing is less about it being inherently beautiful, but exploring what the colors and timbres and possibilities of the voice are. So I think that that's where the crossover with theater is, really, in that I have done some work in theater also, besides just in opera and in avant-garde music. And the most recent thing was I did the score for the Oresteia at the Shakespeare Theater Company last year. And one of the big things that Michael Kahn, the director, was very, very adamant about is don't do anything that's going to influence the way the actors deliver their lines. You know, you have to give them freedom to explore their own artistry. And that's something I think that's emphasized more in avant-garde vocal music than it is in opera. In opera, the singer is given the score and you have to deliver it exactly the way that the composer wrote it. But I think what's cool is that's happening now is that there's a little more flexibility working its way even into the classical opera world, a little more autonomy for the performer and allowing them to express the drama the way that their instincts tell them, the same way that you would in a play, which is awesome.
Ruth, what is your background? Did you grow up playing music or singing classically, or where does the music come from?
I grew up in the church. My dad was a preacher, so I started playing piano. The most lessons I had were kindergarten through third grade, and it gave me a really wonderful foundation of being able to kind of read music and to really hear music, and very thankful that I had those early years of piano lessons. Then I started playing by ear and played for church, mostly hymns, up until I was about 19. And then I kind of went away from music because I was more interested in writing, although I always wrote songs ever since I could pick up a pencil. You know, I've been writing songs and poems. And so when I got called into the theater or pulled away from the church into the theater, I think that's when I really turned more towards writing. But my writing still has so much of that music in it. And when I came back to music, it was picking up an accordion. And that was really meant to just help me breathe. And I was using the bellows to just kind of calm myself. I was really deep in the academic world. So I wanted to get away from thinking too much. So I used the accordion, and at first I was just going to use it as kind of making different sounds with it. But then I started playing more folk music, and that sent me on a long, probably 12, 15 year jaunt of playing in a band that was touring all over the place. And we were always small, but we thought big, I guess, in terms of our ideas. And I'm still in a band and I still play music, but I'm really self-taught in terms of that. I kind of move between my writing and playing and singing just really for fun most of the time.
What I love is that you talk about the church and leaving the church to find theater. And for me, theater is my church. It's really my sanctuary.
Yes.
And so that's why I love theater so much.
Absolutely. It really is. I feel like it's a deep faith that I never really lost. I think I lost a lot of faith in terms of the religion and organized religion, what I call corporate Christianity, that has really taken over evangelical corporate realism. But that faith is really deep and still. And I think Yogananda's influenced in the lyrics of this are really about instinct and intuition and finding the omnipresence of a moment that is very large. And I think that's where opera has always situated in my consciousness, because a woman like Amelia, who is a wife and a mother, and she has a very strong, real daily existence that reminds me of my sister and my nieces, who are raising large families and very much thinking about their family values. And Amelia is coming from that kind of family value, and yet it has a kind of divine expansion that is infinite in its scope. And I think that's what this aria tries to capture, is that kind of what the Quakers used to call lightning hitting the candlestick. And she talks about that in one of her lyrics.
I love that. Some of the composers and lyricists that I've spoken to in the past have talked to me about these musical diving boards that kind of serve as their inspiration or their springboard to their work. So what was the impetus or diving board into this piece?
It's interesting because there are a couple of different things. Well, one, because it's this sort of activist, but also like it's labor rights and it's women's rights and all of these other things. So it's kind of rough, right? It's not high class society in the way that we might think of it. So I immediately started to think about folk instruments, which is why most of the piece is scored for accordion. But then also Ruth's text pulls from some Hindu mystical writings. And so I kind of wanted to pay tribute to that also. And so there are a lot of Tibetan singing bowl sounds in the accompaniment.
I could hear that.
Yeah. You know, I would almost think of it as more of a plunge pool, if I may. There's one I'm thinking of that I saw when I was in Crete, and it was more like a kind of foot bath, and you could put your feet down in it and you could look out over the mountain. And that's kind of how I feel like I entered into this world of Amelia's, because there's a quietness in her story. And of course, we don't have a lot of her. I can't look at any interviews that I could find. She's not well known, but I feel like there's a kind of quietness that I got from just reading about her life and the way that she became even a silent sentinel, and the Quakers work with silence, and, you know, they gather and they wait for intuition or the divine voice to come into them, and then they speak. And thinking about that and just the kind of permeating silence of her life and the power of that, and the way that she lit this match in front of the president's, you know, in front of the White House, and that's what she got thrown in jail for. And that kind of action that is really surprising in a woman like Amelia. Maybe it even surprised her. So I wanted to kind of show her in that moment and then go back into the ripples of what brought her to that kind of action. Light was also very important, thinking about the way the light would enter her consciousness, and thinking of her daily activities with her children, and also the way that she gets exposed when she has to, when she's really torn apart by the madness of the protests, that when people got really upset with her and tore her clothes. So I feel like there's a kind of light and silence that I was working from in terms of diving into this material.
And I think as women, we all have these different facets of ourselves. And when it comes to movements, women's movement, Black Lives Matter movement, those movements aren't always inviting to all parts of who we are as women.
Yeah, and it was important to me to show that a woman could be thinking of her family in terms of feminism, because I think feminism has gotten a really bad rap, even by my own students that are feminist, but they don't want to embrace this kind of capital F feminism that has a lot of stigma to it. And as I was thinking about this piece, I started thinking feminism is a family value. To have a strong woman, you are an asset to your family. You know, why would you want to be uneducated and to have your children at home now trying to learn from you and you can't help them with their homework? Or even in a family, your partner wants to speak with somebody who can hold a conversation with them, and love, and the most passionate kind of love, comes from a deep dialogue. And if you can't have that deep dialogue with your partner, then what kind of passion and love are you going to have in this kind of partnership? So I think that this is a very passionate woman, and this feminism is an asset to the family. It should not be looked at as a kind of a threat to the man or a threat to the family. I think, yes, it's a threat to patriarchy, but hey, you know, nothing has been able to take that down. So I don't think they need to really be afraid of women's rights because patriarchy is very strong. So,
Kamala, what is the significance of hearing the voice of historical figures like Amelia Hines Walker against the backdrop of the Trump presidency, the Black Lives Matter movement, the naming of the first woman of color as our VP candidate?
I think that it is reclaiming the canon, like Ruth was saying, you know, because what we are as a society and as a nation is we are an agreed upon set of stories. We agree what matters, and we agree upon who we are referencing when we talk about we the people, and that hasn't always included everyone. And you know, the 19th Amendment didn't solve everything. It left out women of color. So the fact that we have Kamala Harris, who is our VP pick for the Democratic Party, coinciding with this milestone is pretty amazing. If you think about it, you know, to think that we've come as far as we have in 100 years, and it's not far enough, but to put it in perspective, there are people alive now who remember when women couldn't vote. It hasn't been that long, really, in the grand scheme of human history. It hasn't been that long. And so I think it's important to have artistic perspectives on our history and on our politics to remind us that this is not just something that you're reading about in your textbook. This is living history. The present moment is a continuation of something that began not that long ago, and we have to protect it because it's still fragile. It's still young. And I think that, sadly, that's what theater does the best. So it's really poor timing that everything is closed right now. But I'm really grateful that companies like Burning Coal are making, you know, are figuring out ways to still engage, because I think that we are missing that as a culture. We're missing the way to process things through art. You can only watch so much Netflix.
Well, and I think if one thing that COVID has shown us, it's how important the arts are in our society, because during this period of self-quarantine, we've all been leaning on the arts for survival. Ruth, I want to ask you, the thing that excites me about this series of plays so much is that there feels like there's an urgency to this work. Like there's something very immediate about it. So do you feel like there's an immediacy to your work when you write, especially a piece like this?
Yes, I feel that there is a kind of almost ecstasy that comes into the aria. And I think that that is something that I'm looking for in my own thinking and my own daily life. Yogananda talks about it as plain living and high thinking. He's talking about liberating man from his mental inharmonies, he calls it, which I really love thinking about that. I think that trying to find those moments where we can really find a larger self or be larger than life, those are the things that take me, at the same time as being outside of myself, most deeply engaged with myself. And so I don't think of art and specifically this piece as being self-centered in a way that a portrait could be. I mean, this of course is not a self-portrait. It's Amelia's portrait that we are making for her that she never got in her own lifetime. You know, I don't really feel that she was honored the way that she should have been. And so it's wonderful to be able to give her a little bit of this glory in this aria. But I think that that's something that that I'm looking for in my own presence and my own work. And as we spend all this time alone, you know, in quarantine, those of us who are quarantining mostly alone, it's an interesting thing because the title is Lost Music from the Heart of Everything. And that is a nod, of course, to Yogananda's poem. But I think of this moment when I was, it was about sunset one night, and I'd been fasting with in solidarity with my friends who were fasting for Ramadan. So maybe that was also entering into it. I knew the sun was setting. I was going to be getting to eat soon. But I was playing my accordion, and I was trying to rehearse for something that I'm supposed to be recording and learning a piece, but I found myself playing something that I already knew, and it was in my memory already. And I found myself being able to hear the music in a way that I have not heard it in probably hundreds of performances, hundreds of rehearsals. And so when I think about this idea of lost music and the music that we're losing that Kamala was just talking about, you know, not being able to use the theater in the way that it's built to contribute to this moment in time. But with all of that lost music and that lost opportunity to perform, there's a kind of hearing that we can be open to in a new way that I think this aria and the work that I'm trying to write right now is really trying to find this. It's almost as if we're remembering something ancient, something from deep within ourselves, but it's also far from ourselves that is much larger than life. And so that is really living. That's when we are fully alive and taking up the kind of presence that we have been blessed to have as human beings. And I hope that we can find more of these kind of recognitions of that experience.
Kamala, how about you? Do you feel there's an immediacy or an urgency to your work?
I feel like there's sort of a dichotomy between wanting to respond and wanting to give space. So one of the first things that I did when everything shut down is I actually made a short opera that was intended to be performed over Zoom. And we did three performances of this piece, which was very particular because, as you may have experienced, you can't actually perform in synchronous time over Zoom. There's a lag, which means that you can never line up with anyone else. And what's interesting about that is that experience, sort of what I was talking with you about before, about giving performers more autonomy, doing that meant having to give the performers more autonomy than ever before because they had to decide when they were going to come in based on what they were hearing, which is not the same as what anyone else was hearing, if that makes sense. So that felt urgent and immediate because it felt like responding to a need in the moment. Like, if we're going to be doing this for a long time, how do we do it? How do we make sense of it? And since then, I've felt sort of like pulling back a little bit. I feel like, especially after the George Floyd murder and the protests and everything that's happening, I feel and I sense that there is sort of a fatigue. And so I'm trying to figure out how to balance still giving voice to the present moment, but also making space for other people who maybe didn't have space before. But that being said, I do think that art helps people to process through this moment. And so I'm trying to be thoughtful about the things that I'm making and how that is impacting the world. in a way that I didn't necessarily do before. And I've always tried to make art that is grounded in social justice and that tries to put people on stage who aren't always there. But I think that this feels like a different moment. It feels like we are all sort of taking a breath, and then I think that there's going to be a big surge in energy in the next couple of months. That's sort of my gut feeling right now, as we're all preparing for some kind of, the word that's popping into my head is a battle. I think we're all kind of aware of what's at stake now, if that makes sense.
When we look at the canon of political theater, or we look at political theater, do these types of plays or compositions have the ability, do you think, to change our collective consciousness and the way we view history and our present?
Well, I think all theater is political. And I know that that's maybe not an opinion shared by everybody, but, you know, in making a play or putting on an opera, you're putting a perspective on stage, right? And so for a long time, that has been a white, cisgendered male perspective, but that's still a perspective. So I do think that putting perspectives that are not what has been considered the norm shifts thinking. I think that it can make a change. Maybe not in the way of like radical instant change, but I think that it changes people's thinking over time by providing them with exemplars that are different from that supposed norm, so that eventually there becomes a new norm.
Yes, I think we just have to we have to take a stand with everything we do. I feel that this has been something that I learned from working with Fred Ho and others through the years. Just what Kamala is saying is very true, that everything's political. You know, you can not have a political message, but there's a very strong message in what is dominant culture, what is. And if there's no resistance to dominant culture, then you are complicit in that dominant culture and you are advocating for it to continue. So it is our job as artists to decide how we will manifest these small platforms or large platforms, whatever it is that we have in front of us. And this particular moment in time, it's I think it's wonderful that we get to look back at suffrage and the women that came before us and gave us the right to vote. You know, it's to take that opportunity to give limelight to this woman who was kind of maybe insignificant in the grand scheme of the canon of political players, but she had a huge impact, and we can look at her and really see that her action had a rippling effect to the suffrage movement. And if it weren't for her and others like her, and if it weren't for me and for Kamala and for you, you know, thinking about these things and taking actions and helping to advocate for whatever it is we are advocating for on a daily level. Our Facebook page, our Instagram page, those are billboards in our times. And so what we say becomes an emblem for our small group of friends and family, and that gets broadcast. As we live in America, we are still people are we there's an amplifying that happens because we live in America and people look at America and see what we're doing, and so whatever we do is going to be amplified. And we have to realize that that is political. And so maybe this is not the most political step that we could take. I think we can always do more, and there's a constant meditation that I'm doing with, like, what can I do with the resources I have to sustain myself and my practice and the practice of those around me and my neighbors and friends, you know, what can I do to contribute to that in a political way that will make my citizenry contribution to this moment in time. And there's always more we can do. But also I think that the fatigue that Kamala mentioned is real. And that's something that we also have to realize can be really paralyzing for an artist if we don't take care of ourselves and give ourselves something to look forward to and, you know, kind of get out of bed in the morning, then we will not be able to even create. So I think that there is a kind of self-care that has to enter into this moment of time that is also political.
Kamala, you are in the, you're in New York, which is the heart of the Dear White American Theater movement that we've seen. So what do you think? Does this moment mark a cultural shift in the kinds of stories that we're going to see on our main stages, and who gets to tell those stories?
I think it marks a cultural shift, but I don't think any of us know what that will be yet. Because the truth of the matter is that we are not going to be back in theaters together until 2021. And who knows how far into 2021 that will start to happen. And what that means is that there are a lot of institutions that are going to have to radically restructure in order to survive. And I can see them doing this in one of two ways. Either they'll lose their risk aversion because they have to. In order to survive, they have to adopt radical new practices. And that includes trying to bring in people who did not feel welcome in the theater before by putting those stories on stage from people who have lived those experiences. So I think that there is a world in which theater allows this breakdown of the world to create a restructuring that is more equitable. But there's also the alternate possibility, which is that they operate from a place of fear. They're afraid that they are going to lose their building, not be able to pay their staff. And so they do the opposite, which is to sort of pull inward and go back to the practices that they think they know will work, which means the same established playwrights and composers and the same networks as before. Right now, because of George Floyd, I think we're skewing more towards the more equitable version, but without George Floyd, who knows where we could be, and who knows where we're going to be in a couple of months if the rest of us don't keep the pressure on and keep reminding those people in gatekeeping positions that equity is the way forward that we want, that we're looking for. So I think that it's kind of an open-ended possibility at this point. But regardless, there will be some cultural restructuring because there has to be. I don't think the world on the other side of the pandemic is going to be the same one that we left. There's no way that it can be.
In learning about Amelia Hymes Walker, what do you think she would say if she were here now about the women's movement and the Black Lives Matter movement?
You know, it's hard to put words in her mouth, but I think that she would be right along with everybody. You know, I think she would be out protesting. I think she would be singing. Stephanie, when I talked with her about the aria, the woman who is singing the performance, she said, Amelia should have sung this, you know, because she was a singer. She sang beautifully. She was trained as a singer. So she might have put on her operatic dress that you can see in the Historic Society and gone out and sang this aria. But I think there's also a possibility that she would use her silence, this kind of silent sentinel. I don't know a whole lot about the Sentinels of Silence, but they remind me of Women in Black. I don't know if you know that movement. Some of my friends are in Serbia. They work a lot with the they're sort of happenings where women just wear black and stand in silence at Srebrenica or, you know, mass graves or protest genocide or violence of some sort. And that silence is very powerful when you see the women in black just standing there. So it's something that I think Amelia had. I was talking about her growing up as a Quaker, and as I read about what the Quakers believe, they were very progressive in terms of women's rights and racial equality too. They were very active in the civil rights movement. They just did not believe that a master and a slave were different, you know, that a woman was different than a man in terms of what God sees, you know, and what there was no hierarchy. And so they would let women speak. And I think that that is an interesting thing that Amelia would perhaps speak, you know, she might give a speech. That would be amazing to hear what she would have said. But she might have also used her silence or lit another match and burnt an effigy of Trump on fire. That would be great. We need a little more of that.
I think I'm just thinking about what I would say, which is really still. But yeah, I think she would be there. I think she would be there still protesting and being part of the movement. Maybe she is there in a strange way. You know, there seemed to be an awakening in a lot of people this spring. As you know, I have done my fair share of protesting in my life, and I felt very discouraged after, you know, protesting for Eric Garner in New York and not seeing anything and not seeing really much of a change, not only in New York, but across the country. And I felt very discouraged. And I have felt discouraged, of course, these last 3 years, but this time felt different. I do feel like I'm having conversations about Black Lives Matter and about police brutality with people that never would have talked about this before, that would never ever have agreed with me before. Like even my very evangelical aunt, who we don't agree about anything, she said, well, yes, of course, I know that Black people are treated differently by the police. And I just was shocked because that is not something I expected to hear. So I feel like maybe she is here. Maybe her spirit has infused people in some way, because I do feel a change.
I want to thank Margraf and Shankaram for spending time with me and talking to me about Lost Music from the Heart of Everything, a suffrage aria for Amelia Hymes Walker. This piece is available to watch virtually through September 30th. I'll put links in the episode notes. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to this podcast, become a patron of the show, follow us on social media at RDU on Stage, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next time, I'll see you at the theater.
I knock on your prison walls with blows of faith. I covet the language of the angels and sheet music alone.